You know, I was at a coffee shop this morning, paying a bill on my phone, scrolling social media, just doing the normal digital life stuff. And it all feels so solid. Like the internet is this permanent utility, right? Like water from a tap.
It absolutely does. It's designed to feel that way.
Yeah.
Until, of course, it doesn't.
Exactly. And that's what we're really digging into today. Because looking at our source material, which is this cheat sheet for a high-level internet system security exam, you realize something pretty quick. The ground beneath our feet isn't concrete at all. It's more like a lattice of plywood and duct tape that we've all just agreed to trust.
That is a frighteningly accurate metaphor. And honestly, that's how most security people see the world. Not as a fortress, but as a just a series of patches.
So, welcome to the deep dive. We're not doing the news cycle today. We're doing a crash course. We're taking this exam guide, which cuts through all the marketing you usually hear about cyber defense. And we're going to look at the actual plumbing. We're talking about why the internet breaks, how the cybercrime economy really works, which is wild, and why we're still seeing massive data breaches every week.
And what I love about this source is that it doesn't try to scare you with, hackers and hoodies typing green code. It treats security as an engineering problem and, crucially, as an economic one.
Right. It's not magic, it's just mechanics. So, okay, help us set the stage here. The guide starts with a framework. Before we get to all the hacks and spies, what is it we're actually trying to protect?
So, in the industry and in this course, everything revolves around what's called the CIA triad.
Which has nothing to do with the intelligence agency, for the record.
Nothing at all. It stands for confidentiality, integrity, and availability. It sounds simple, but every single security failure you read about is a failure of one of those three.
Okay, so break that down for us.
Confidentiality is the one everyone kind of gets instinctively. Did someone steal the credit card numbers? Did they read your private emails? If, yes, you failed confidentiality, it's about keeping secrets secret.
Simple enough.
Then there's integrity. This is all about, did someone change the data? If you log into your bank and your balance says zero, but you didn't spend it, that's an integrity failure. The data isn't trustworthy anymore. And finally, you have availability. Is the system even running? If a whole website goes down on its biggest sales day because of an attack, that's a classic availability failure.
So keep it secret, keep it accurate, and keep it online.
Exactly.
But that's the million-dollar question, isn't it? If the goal is that simple, just those three things, why is it so incredibly hard? Why does it always feel like the attackers are winning?
This is where the source material gets really, really interesting. It argues that security isn't just a technical problem we haven't found the right code for yet. It's an incentive problem. Think about it from a business angle. Security is a negative deliverable.
A negative deliverable? That sounds like corporate speak for a waste of money.
Well, in a way, yeah. It means if I do my job perfectly as a security engineer, what happens?
Nothing.
Nothing happens. You don't get a return on investment you can see on a spreadsheet. You just don't get hacked. But if you're a product manager and you ship a new feature, you can measure that. So companies are just naturally incentivized to pay for features, not for the absence of a disaster.
That makes perfect sense. It's like insurance. Nobody wants to pay for it until their house is on fire.
Precisely. And then you add complexity on top of that. The guide makes this point that complexity is the absolute enemy of security. We're building systems so interconnected that, nobody, literally nobody, understands the whole picture anymore.
Bad incentives and systems too complex to manage. Sounds like a perfect environment for bad actors.
It is. It's the perfect storm.
Speaking of bad actors, I want to talk about the abuse ecosystem because I think most people still have this image of the hacker, the lone genius in a
The
basement.
war games scenario.
Right. But this guide, it paints a picture that looks a lot more like, I don't know, a Fortune 500 company.
It really is. We've moved way past the lone wolf era. This is industrialized cybercrime. It is a full-blown economy. And just like the real software world has software as a service, the criminal world has COS.
Crime as a service.
Crime as a service. It sounds like a joke, but it's very real. Let's say you want to infect 1,000 computers. 10 years ago, you had to write the virus, find the vulnerabilities, build the control server. You had to be a jack of all
A
trades.
full stack engineer of crime.
Exactly. But now, you just go to a marketplace, you find an access broker who's already hacked 1,000 networks, you buy the access, then you go to a malware as a service provider and you just rent the ransomware. You can even hire a customer support
Wait,
team.
hold on. Customer support. You're telling me if I get hit with ransomware, I might be talking to a call center.
In many cases, yes. Think about it. If you lock up a hospital's data, you need someone to pick up the phone and calmly explain to an administrator how to buy Bitcoin. If your customer experience is bad, you don't get paid. So they specialize. They have reputations to maintain.
That is just terrifyingly efficient. The notes also mention paper install. Is that what it sounds like?
It's exactly what it sounds like. It's affiliate marketing, but for malware. Bad guys run these big networks of infected computers, botnets. You pay them a few cents per machine, and they will push your malware onto all of them. You don't need to know how to hack. You just need some cash.
So the barrier to entry is basically zero.
It's purely financial now. If you have capital, you can be a cyber criminal. The technical skill isn't the primary requirement anymore.
Which brings up the obvious question. If it's all so organized, why can't we just shut it down? Why don't the feds just raid the data centers?
Well, they try. We see these big takedowns all the time. But the source talks about the economics of intervention. And the hard truth is these takedowns are often just a speed bump.
Because the demand is still there.
Right. It's a market. If you take down the biggest marketplace for stolen credit cards, the demand for those cards doesn't just vanish. The buyers and sellers just move to a new platform. It's the Hydra effect.
Hmm.
Cut off one head, two more pop up.
So what's the actual solution then?
The guide argues you have to think differently. You can't just arrest your way out of the problem. You have to increase the economic friction. You have to make it expensive and annoying to be a criminal. If you can raise their costs, burn their payment channels, erode their profit margins, you have to attack the business model itself.
It's just weird to think about fighting crime with a better P&L analysis.
But that's the game now. It's a business, and you have to bankrupt them.
Okay, let's get a bit more technical. We've talked about the criminals. Let's talk about their tools. The notes have this alphabet soup of acronyms for vulnerabilities, CVEs, CVSS. What are these?
Think of it as the bookkeeping of the security world. A vulnerability is just a mistaken code. When one is found, it gets a CVE ID. Common vulnerabilities and exposures. It's like a serial number for a bug.
And the CVSS.
That's the severity score. 0 to 10. A 10 is drop everything you're doing. The building is on fire. A 2 is more like fix it when you can.
Okay, so this leads to a concept that I found really counterintuitive. The zero day. In movies, it's the ultimate weapon, right? The key that unlocks everything. But the guide seems to suggest they aren't the biggest problem for most companies.
They really aren't, and that's a huge misconception. A zero day is a vulnerability that the vendor, so Microsoft or Apple, doesn't know about yet. There is no patch. It's effectively indefensible in that moment.
Which sounds incredibly scary.
Oh, it is. But they're also super expensive to find, and they're rare. If you're a nation state trying to hack a nuclear facility, sure, you'll use a zero day. But for 99% of attacks, the real problem is end days.
End days. As in bugs that do have a patch.
Exactly. Bugs that have been known for n number of days. The guide makes it super clear that most breaches use vulnerabilities that have been public for months, sometimes years.
Wait, so the patch exists. The company knows it exists. Why haven't they applied it? Is it just laziness?
It's rarely laziness, it's fear. In a big company, applying a patch isn't like updating your phone. It might break something critical. Patch Tuesday can easily become broken Wednesday.
Yeah.
So IT admins are, you know, hesitant. They want to test everything first. And while they're testing,
the attackers pounce.
The attackers pounce. It's a race. The second a vulnerability is disclosed, the second it becomes an end day, the clock starts. Attackers have automated tools scanning the entire internet for that one specific bug.
That's a key point. They aren't targeting you, they're targeting the bug, and you just happen to have it.
Exactly. It's opportunistic. You're just the low-hanging fruit.
The notes have this great phrase, vulnerabilities are atypical information goods. What does that even mean?
It means they behave weirdly as a product. A zero day has an immense value because it's secret. I can sell it for a ton of money, but the second I use it or the second it gets discovered, the vendor patches it, and its value just plummets to zero. Instantly.
It's a perishable good, like a banana that rots the second you take a bite.
That's a perfect way to put it. It forces this use it or lose it mentality.
Let's shift gears a bit. We've talked about software bugs, but I want to talk about the plumbing. The infrastructure, the guide mentions scanning the internet, and this tool called ZMAP.
Oh, yeah. ZMAP changed everything.
How? I mean, the internet is huge. There are, what, 4 billion IPv4 addresses? How do you even begin to scan that?
Well, before ZMAP, if you wanted to scan the whole internet for, say, a specific vulnerable server, it would take you weeks, maybe months. ZMAP can do it in under an hour.
How is that possible?
It cheats. Basically, in a normal, polite network conversation, my computer says hello, Your computer says hello back, and I acknowledge that. It takes time. It takes memory. ZMapp doesn't care about being polite. It just screams hello and immediately moves on. It doesn't wait for a reply in the same way. It's stateless.
So it's shouting at 4 billion doors at once and just jotting down who answers?
That's it, exactly. And this lets researchers and attackers take a snapshot of the entire internet security posture in near real time. It completely changed the game.
But the notes say this only works for IPv4, the old addresses.
Right. We're moving to IPv6. And the address space for IPv6 is, well, it's astronomically large. It's not just bigger. It's mind-bogglingly bigger.
Yep.
You couldn't ZMap the IPv6 space if you had millions of years.
So is IPv6 more secure just because you can't find anything?
Security by obscurity. Sort of. You can't brute force it. You have to be smart. You have to look at DNS records, find patterns. You have to be a detective, not just a brute.
Speaking of finding things, we have to talk about BGP, the Border Gateway Protocol. The guide calls it the glue of the internet, but it also makes it sound like very, very weak glue.
BGP is a relic of a kinder, gentler internet. It's the system that lets different networks like Comcast, Google, AT&T tell each other which IP addresses they control. Hey, send traffic for this IP address over to me.
Okay, seems necessary.
The problem is, it was designed in the 80s when the internet was like a handful of universities and the military. So the whole protocol just operates on trust. If I stand up and say, hey everyone, I own YouTube's IP addresses now, BGP doesn't have a built-in police force to say, no, you don't. It just believes me.
That seems like a massive oversight for the world we live in now.
It is, and we've seen it go horribly wrong. The classic case study in the guide is the Pakistan telecom incident from 2008.
Right. Walk us through that one.
So the Pakistani government wanted to block YouTube in their country. So Pakistan Telecom configured its routers to announce, hey, we are the best path to YouTube's IP addresses. Their plan was to just route all that traffic into a black hole.
Standard censorship.
But they made a mistake. They accidentally announced this route to the rest of the world. And because of a quirk in how BGP works, it prefers more specific routes, the rest of the internet looked at this announcement from Pakistan and said, oh, that looks like a better, more direct path to YouTube.
Oh, no. So the entire world started sending its YouTube traffic to Pakistan.
Yes. Within minutes, YouTube was offline globally. All because the protocol just blindly trusted this one announcement. It perfectly highlights that fragility we started with.
The pipes are leaky.
The pipes are very, very leaky. And fixing BGP is incredibly hard because you basically have to get everyone on the internet to agree on a new standard all at once.
Another way the pipes get enthused is DDoS. And the notes talk about reflection and amplification attacks. This sounds like physics.
It's a force multiplier. Imagine I want to punch you, but I'm weak. So instead, I poke a huge bear and I tell the bear that you did it.
Okay, I'm with you.
The bear mauls you. That's amplification. In the digital world, an attacker spoofs the victim's IP address. They pretend to be the victim. Then they send a tiny request to some public server, like a DNS server, asking for a huge amount of data.
So I send a whisper.
And the server screams back. But because you fake the return address, the screen goes to the victim, not you. You can turn 1 megabyte of traffic into 50 or 100 megabytes of attack traffic.
Wait.
And the poor server in the middle has no idea it's even part of an attack.
That's so devious. It uses the internet's own infrastructure against itself.
Exactly. It turns the helpfulness of the internet into a weapon.
All right, let's move up the stack from the network to the web, the browser, the things we actually click on. The guide lists a kind of greatest hits of web vulnerabilities, XSS, SQL injection. Why are these still a thing?
Because the web was built to display documents, not run your entire bank. We just sort of shoehorned all this interactivity into it. Take XSS cross-site scripting.
What's the simple version of that?
It's when a website confuses data with code. Imagine a comment section. It should just display text. But if I post a comment that contains a little bit of JavaScript and the website isn't careful, it might just run that script in the browser of anyone who reads my comment.
And then my browser is suddenly sending you my login cookies.
Exactly. The browser trusts the website. The website trusted my input. And that chain of trust gets completely exploited.
And what about SQL injection?
Same basic idea, but it attacks the database behind the website. It happens when developers build database queries by just gluing strings of text together. If I type a very specific phrase into a login box, I can trick the database into thinking my input is actually a command, like log me in ORR11.
Since one always equals one.
The database says true and lets me write in, no password needed. It's like linguistic hacking.
The one that really made me facepalm was IDOR, broken access control.
Insecure direct object reference. Yeah,
It sounds so fancy, but the example is just so basic. You log in, the URL says user equals 100. You change it to user equals 101, and boom, you're looking at someone else's private account.
It happens all the time. The system checks, is this person logged in? Yes. But it forgets to check, is this person allowed to see this specific data?
Yeah.
It's like having a key to the building lobby and assuming that means you can just walk into the CEO's office.
Seems like such a rookie mistake.
It is, but developers are always under pressure. You build the functionality first, make the page load. Security is often a checkbox you tick at the very end, and things get missed.
We've covered so much ground. The broken protocols, the crime economy, the web bugs. The guide wraps this all up with the attack lifecycle or the kill chain. So if I'm a company, how does a hack actually go down step by step?
It's almost always a sequence. It starts with reconnaissance, scanning your network, checking LinkedIn for employees, then initial access, maybe a phishing email, maybe exploiting one of those end-day bugs.
They get a toehold.
Right. But they usually land on some low-level machine.
Mm-hmm.
That's not where the good stuff is. So next is privilege escalation, getting admin rights.
Yeah.
And then the big one, lateral movement.
Moving sideways through the network.
Exactly. And the guide emphasizes a critical point here. NAT is not a firewall.
Explain that. I think a lot of people think their home router makes them safe.
NAT, or network address translation, just hides your internal IP address. It's like living in an apartment building. The main building has an address, but your specific apartment number isn't in the public phone book.
Okay, so I'm unlisted. That feels safe.
It helps. No one can just cold call your computer. But if
yeah.
I can get one person inside your apartment to call me, say, by clicking a phishing link, I have a connection, I'm on the line. And once I'm inside that network, if there are no internal walls, which we call a flat network, I can walk out of your apartment and try the door to every other apartment on the floor.
So being hidden is not the same as being secure.
Never. If you're relying on NAT for security, you have a hard shell and a soft, chewy center. Once that shell is cracked, it's game over.
This brings us to the end of the cheat sheet. And honestly, the conclusion is a bit sobering. It calls security a socio-technical system.
That's the fancy way of saying you can't just fix this with code. You're managing this messy combination of old protocols, bad economic incentives, and just plain human error.
So is the takeaway that we're all doomed? We should just disconnect and live in the woods?
No, no. The real takeaway is that perfect security is a total myth. The goal isn't to be bulletproof. The goal is to manage risk. It's to make the cost of attacking you higher than the value of whatever you're protecting. It's about being secure enough.
It grounds the whole discussion. We're not fighting a war we can win. We're just managing a chronic condition.
That is the perfect way to put it. It's chronic condition management.
So here is the thought I want to leave you with today. We rely on this thing for our banking, our democracy, our social lives, but its fundamental protocols, BGP, IPv4, the way we build websites, they all rely on a level of trust that just doesn't exist anymore. And the economic incentives, they almost always favor speed over safety. So ask yourself, is security actually a solvable problem? Or are we just stuck permanently negotiating acceptable levels of failure?
That's the question that keeps security engineers up at night.
Thanks for taking the plunge with us. Check your URLs, update your software.
Seriously, update your software.
And we'll catch you in the next deep dive.